The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Fred Woodward from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from The Week magazine, the best of the U.S. and international media each week. The Triangle Radio Reading Service thanks Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's Reading of the Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. We're reading this week from the May 10th, 2019 issue of The Week magazine. The cover drawing this week shows Joe Biden. He's on the platform at a train station. Looks like he's got about 20 suitcases in his arms and stacked behind him. He's got his classic big toothy smile going. And posted on the various suitcases are stickers. One says Biden 08. One says Biden 88. 1994 crime bill, anti-school busing, Anita Hill, war on drugs, et cetera, et cetera. And the headline is Biden's baggage. Is he too old, too white, and too centrist for modern Democrats? And we'll pick that up on the controversy of the week, but we'll start with the main story titled Mueller's Rift with the Attorney General. What happened? An extraordinary rupture between Special Counsel Robert Mueller and Attorney General William Barr became public this week when it was revealed that Mueller complained that Barr's four-page summary of his findings was misleading. In a letter written on March 27th and leaked this week, Mueller wrote that Barr's summary, in which the Attorney General absolved President Trump of collusion and obstruction of justice, did not fully capture the context, nature, and substance of this office's work and conclusions, and had left the public confused about critical aspects of the results. Mueller also asked Barr to immediately release the special counsel's own summaries of the Russia investigation's findings. Barr did not, waiting three more weeks to release a redacted version of Mueller's final report, again claiming it exonerated the president. At a highly contentious hearing of the Senate Judiciary Committee, Barr this week called Mueller's letter a bit snitty and defended his own interpretation of the investigation's findings. Mueller's work concluded when he sent his report to the Attorney General, Barr said. At that point, it was my baby. Barr also continued to defend Trump's conduct during the Russia investigation. The president's many attempts to curtail or end the investigation, including asking for Mueller to be fired or told not to investigate the 2016 election, were not obstruction of justice, Barr said, because Trump was falsely accused. Several Democrats called on Barr to resign. Later, the Attorney General said he would not testify about the Mueller report before the Democratic-controlled House Judiciary Committee, citing its plan to have staff lawyers question him. What the columnist said: Barr is rocketing up the list of worst attorneys general in history, said Charles Pierce in Esquire.com. It was already obvious that Barr grossly distorted the Mueller report in his four-page summary, allowing the White House to shape the narrative for a few crucial days. Now we know his behavior was even more egregious than that. Barr had already received Mueller's letter when he was asked in a Senate hearing on April 10th whether the special counsel supported his decision to clear the president on obstruction of justice. I don't know whether Bob Mueller supported my conclusion, Barr said, a deliberate lie under oath. It's now obvious that Barr should be impeached and removed from office. Mueller's complaints are trivial, said Andrew McCarthy in FoxNews.com. The special counsel didn't actually dispute that Barr accurately summarized the report's no crime bottom line. Mueller was miffed because he wanted to slime Trump with all the unpresidential escapades that were uncovered but didn't lead to criminal charges. But that's not a prosecutor's job. That's the stuff of political narratives. Mueller has a good reason to be angry, said Jennifer Rubin in the Washington Post. in documenting 10 instances of possible obstruction by Trump. He noted he couldn't indict a sitting president under existing guidelines, but said there are constitutional processes for addressing presidential misconduct. That is, impeachment hearings by Congress. But Barr took it upon himself to clear the president anyway. The strategy works, said David Graham in TheAtlantic.com. Even though the report can read as an impeachment referral to Congress, Trump and his allies had 3 weeks to bake in Barr's conclusion that the president had been cleared. By the time its full text was released, the ardor for impeachment hearings among legislators and the public had faded. If Mueller wanted President Trump or members of his campaign brought up on obstruction of justice charges, he should have said so, said Tiana Lowe in WashingtonExaminer.com. Instead, he punted. So Barr was within his rights as Attorney General to draw his own conclusions. It's not Barr's fault that Mueller didn't like the resulting media coverage. The stage is now set for a constitutional battle royale, said Noah Feldman in Bloomberg.com. House Democrats are following up on Mueller with a blizzard of subpoenas and separate investigations into Trump's taxes and his businesses. Trump says he'll fight the subpoenas and refuse to let anyone in the White House testify. Executive privilege and Congress' right to investigate are both products of constitutional interference, custom, and raw assertion of power. But if the courts aren't willing to act as referees, Trump and Congress may be at an impasse. We are truly in uncharted waters. And the controversy of the week, referring, as we saw, to the cover drawing, is titled Biden, Democrats' Best Bet to Beat Trump. Joe Biden's limitations as a presidential candidate are so obvious that they're almost a litany, said David Ignatius in the Washington Post. The former vice president, who last week officially declared his candidacy, is too old, too white, too male, too touchy-feely, and generally too out of touch with the progressive base of the party he seeks to lead in 2020. But Biden has one huge plus over the dizzying array of other Democrats. He may have the best chance of beating Donald Trump. Polls show Biden leading Trump by 8 points in a theoretical matchup, and his blue-collar bona fides could help Democrats win back the Rust Belt states that so narrowly went for Trump in 2016. Biden came out of the gate making a direct pitch for those votes, said Jennifer Agiesta in CNN.com. Calling himself a union man at a rally in Pittsburgh, Biden said the country had been built by the great American middle class that has been forsaken by Washington. So far, donors and voters like what they hear. Biden raised $6.3 million in his first 24 hours, more than any other Democrat, and surged to 39% in a new CNN poll of Democratic voters, head and shoulders above the 19 other declared candidates, including his chief rival, Senator Bernie Sanders, who sank to only 15%. Let's hope Biden enjoyed his launch, said Joan Walsh in TheNation.com, because it could be his best week on the trail. Deciding to center his campaign on blue-collar white men might be a plausible strategy in a general election, but it will hurt him in the wide, diverse primary field of younger, fresher candidates. The progressives who vote in Democratic primaries aren't looking for a white male savior to rescue them from Trumpism, said Virginia Heffernan in the Los Angeles Times. And they haven't forgotten that Biden took part in the unconscionable bullying of Anita Hill during Clarence Thomas Supreme Court confirmation hearings in 1991. It's time for a woman or person of color to lead. Biden may not be woke enough for Democratic Party voters, said National Review in an editorial, but no one should be fooled into thinking he is a moderate. In his 35 years in Washington, Biden has supported every left-wing cause from higher taxes to hate crimes laws, to liberal judicial activism. The biggest threat to Biden's viability is not his politics, but Biden himself, said Frank Rich in NYMag.com. The 76-year-old has a long history of gaffes and florid, even embarrassing rhetoric. He simply may not be culturally limber enough to survive the perpetual meat grinder of the modern news cycle. And how will his folksy bromides hold up in debates with the formidable Elizabeth Warren, Kamala Harris, and Pete Buttigieg? Biden just needs to be himself, said Anna Navarro in CNN.com. No, he's never going to set hearts racing, but he's an indisputably decent human being who has survived the tragic loss of his first wife, a daughter, and a son. Deeply empathetic, he inspires a feeling of trust and confidence, and is thus Trump's exact opposite. Incandescent progressives may prefer someone younger and further left, said George Will in the Washington Post, but candidate congestion could split the progressive primary vote among Sanders, Warren, Harris, and the rest. That gives Biden a clear path down the moderate lane. In a nation both embarrassed and exhausted by years of Trump, the familiar, unexciting Joe Biden may be the restful candidate voters devoutly desire. Time for our Good Week, Bad Week segment. It was a good week for the devil, whose official North American church, the Satanic Temple, has been awarded tax-exempt status by the IRS. Founded by atheists in 2013, the temple seeks to highlight and mock government officials' favoring of specific religions. It was a good week for omens, with the birth of a Montana cattle ranch on a Montana cattle ranch of a two-headed calf. I honestly didn't want to look at it when I realized what it was, said rancher Heather Herman, age 30. And it was a good week for equality, after the Scottish Maritime Museum announced that it will henceforth stop referring to ships as she. I think that we have to move with the time, said Director David Mann, who reached the decision after woke vandals defaced two of the museum's signs. But it was a bad week for Americans, after a new Gallup poll found that we are some of the most stressed out people in the world, with 55% saying they'd felt a lot of stress the day before, way above the global average of 35%. Democrats were among the most stressed. It was a bad week for milestones, after President Trump uttered the 10,000th false or misleading statement of his presidency, according to Washington Post fact checkers. In the past 7 months, Trump has averaged 23 false or misleading claims a day, including such whoppers as claiming that his border wall is already being built. It was a bad week for faking it, after a study by the Institute of Labor Economics found that both males and wealthy people are more likely to pretend to know what they're talking about when asked to discuss non-existent mathematical concepts such as proper numbers and declarative fractions. On the briefing page now, Greta Thunberg's climate crusade. An autistic teenager from Sweden is trying to shame adults into action. Who is she? Greta Thunberg is a 16-year-old Swedish schoolgirl whose school strike for climate change campaign has sparked a global youth movement involving hundreds of thousands of teenagers in more than 100 countries. In the past few months, she has met with Pope Francis and addressed the EU, the UN, and the British Parliament. At the World Economic Forum in Davos, Switzerland, she told corporate executives and political leaders that their greed was robbing her generation of its future. For every audience, she delivers the same blunt message, drawing on last year's alarming report from the UN Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. Around the year 2030, 10 years, 252 days, and 10 hours away from now, she told Parliament last week in perfect English, we will be in a position where we set off an irreversible chain reaction beyond human control. If adult leaders don't act, she says, their irresponsible behavior will no doubt be remembered in history as one of the greatest failures of humankind. How did her movement begin? Thornburg said she was inspired by the students from Parkland, Florida, who walked out of classes on March 2018 to protest gun violence after 17 of their classmates and teachers were massacred in a school shooting. Last summer, Sweden suffered through its most extreme heat spell on record, with temperatures in the 90s and forest bursting into flame above the Arctic Circle. Fed up with inaction, Thunberg decided one day last August not to go to school and instead sat alone outside the Swedish Parliament building with a sign saying, "School Strike for Climate." On the second day of Thunberg's protest, other students joined her, and they kept it up for nearly a month until the Swedish elections. Thereafter, she led school strikes every Friday, and they soon spread to Belgium, the Netherlands, and other countries through the hashtag Fridays for Future. On March 15th, some 1.5 million students in 2,000 cities around the world turned out for a global strike. What led her to this cause? Thunberg has been diagnosed with autism spectrum disorder, ADHD, and selective mutism, a disorder that interferes with speech. I have always been that girl in the back who doesn't say anything, she says. She was just 11 years old when she became concerned about climate change through school, after viewing films about deforestation, plastic clogging the oceans, and the melting of polar ice. The discovery that her planet's future was in peril helped plunge the sensitive young girl into a deep depression. She stopped going to school, stopped talking, and even stopped eating, stunting her growth. Thunberg eventually emerged from her depression when she decided she could do something to prevent the bleak future that scared her so. The once silent child now routinely addresses crowds of thousands of people and gives eloquent interviews. It's like day and night, says her father, Svante Thunberg. It is an incredible transformation. How has her autism influenced her? People like Thunberg who have Asperger's syndrome, a mild form of autism, tend to be very literal and ruthlessly logical. Most neurotypical people can live with the cognitive dissonance that comes with accepting the reality of climate change, but doing nothing about it. For Thunberg, that contradiction is intolerable. She is relentless in her marshaling of science, logic, and morality to make her case. Her first converts were her parents, who have adopted her veganism and traded their car for an electric model. Her mother, Malena Ernman, a famous Swedish opera singer, has given up flying because of the carbon-intensive exhaust that planes emit. That decision has limited her career. What do her critics say? Some have charged that Thunberg was put up to her campaign by environmental groups or green energy companies. But Thunberg and her family say she has never received a dime for her work. Still, she has other detractors. When she met the Pope, Italian newspapers denounced her as a pain in the ass, and her movement as a mere excuse to skip school. Just last week, conservative British journalist Brendan O'Neill mocked her autistic affect, saying her monotone voice made her seem like a cult member. Thunberg isn't fazed. I expected when I started that if this is going to become big, then there will be a lot of hate, she says. Most European governments, though, have praised her message, and Norwegian lawmakers have nominated her for a Nobel Peace Prize. What does she want? Climate scientists say the world must slash emissions of greenhouse gases in half by 2030 and to nearly nothing by 2050 in order to keep warming to 1.5 degrees Celsius. Beyond that mark lie devastating impacts. Extreme droughts and floods, severe storms, food shortages, wildlife extinctions, cataclysmic sea level rise, and mass movements of climate refugees. Thunberg is demanding that governments abide by the emissions reductions they promised to make in the 2016 Paris Climate Agreement. She rejects the buck-passing tendency of adults to place their hopes in young activists like her. I don't want you to be hopeful, Thunberg says. I want you to panic. I want you to feel the fear I feel every day. And then I want you to act. And we'll read a few of our best columns of the week, starting with Ignoring Women Candidates. Why are the Democrats' women candidates being ignored? Ask Alexis Grinnell and Christina Greer. Some polls show Joe Biden, Bernie Sanders, Pete Buttigieg, and Beto O'Rourke all running ahead of the five female candidates running for president, including two with sterling credentials, Elizabeth Warren and Kamala Harris. It's no shock that Biden and Sanders are currently on top, given their previous presidential runs and high name recognition. But it's galling to see previously obscure men with limited accomplishments, like Beto and Mayor Pete, leapfrog over women whose outsized accomplishments and respective resumes would put most people to shame. Warren, a former Harvard professor and influential U.S. senator, every week releases detailed, thoughtful policy proposals to help middle-class Americans. Buttigieg, who won re-election in tiny South Bend, Indiana with roughly 8,500 votes, dismissed policy details as minutia. Harris, a former California attorney general and the second black woman to serve as a U.S. senator, has received far less attention than O'Rourke, a wealthy heir who won fame for losing a Senate race. When women have more qualifications than men, they are inevitably dismissed as less likable. That's pure misogyny. This column comes from the UK. Can we avoid Prime Minister Boris? Time is running out for principled conservatives to prevent that dangerous buffoon, Boris Johnson, from becoming prime minister, said Gabby Hinsliff. Our feckless prime minister, Theresa May, is so despised within her own party that even though she survived a no-confidence motion in December and so can't be challenged by party members for a year, senior conservatives are considering changing the party's rules to allow her to be ousted immediately. And polls show that Conservative Party members want Johnson, fount of the worst lies about Brexit in the run-up to the 2016 referendum, to succeed her. But it's not Boris' pro-Brexit views that upset his critics. Instead, they see in him a worrying recklessness, a willingness to say and do what others would not in pursuit of power. He drops casual anti-Muslim slurs, saying that women in burqas look like letterboxes, and he could easily go further with inflammatory populist rhetoric. Worse, while he pretends to erudition, he is lazy and doesn't read his briefing papers. In ordinary times, conservatives would shut up and rally around a popular figure just to get the win. But years of watching various Republicans in the U.S. wrestle with their consciences for failing to stop Donald Trump have made some British conservatives vow to do better. A handful have already pledged to quit the party if Johnson is made leader. That is the only honorable stance. This is from Pakistan. U.S. blocks aid for rape victims. The Trump administration has made an open declaration of hostility toward women worldwide, said Iman Zainab Mazari Hazir, during what should have been a routine approval last week of a United Nations Security Council resolution condemning sexual violence in wartime. The American delegation insisted that all references to protecting women's sexual and reproductive health be removed. The U.S. said it would veto the resolution if there were any whiff of the idea that a woman raped during war might be allowed to get an abortion. France's U.S. ambassador, François Deletier, called the U.S.'s interference intolerable and incomprehensible, saying women should not be forced to bear their rapist children, and he is right. A married woman who bears such a child can be rejected by her husband. An unmarried one can face social ostracization. Such women are doubly victimized, their lives forever altered with no hope of support from society at large. And the scale of the problem worldwide is staggering. It's not just state armies that prey upon women in conflict zones. UN peacekeepers also commit sexual abuse. In Cambodia alone, nearly 25,000 babies were fathered and abandoned by peacekeepers. Thanks to America's puritanical insistence, the UN will be able to do little to help women subjected to the most intrusive violations of their bodily integrity. The last word, our in-depth article, has a picture of the face of a cow. The photograph is taken from ground level looking up, and the cow's just staring into the camera. The title is "The Future of Hamburgers." To address climate change, we'll have to reduce our consumption of beef, said journalist Michael Grunwald in Politico magazine. That's a tough sell in a country that loves its burgers and steaks. Politicians often rally their supporters with partisan red meat. But these days, Republicans are using actual red meat. They're accusing Democrats of a plot to ban beef, trying to rebrand the Green New Deal for climate action as a nanny state assault on the American diet. At a rally in Michigan, President Donald Trump portrayed a green dystopia with no more cows. In a recent Washington speech, former Trump aide Sebastian Gorka warned conservatives that leftists are coming for their hamburgers. "This is what Stalin dreamt about but never achieved," Representative Rob Bishop, Republican from Utah, actually ate a burger during a press conference on Capitol Hill, an activity he claimed would be illegal under a Green New Deal. In reality, nobody's banning beef. Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, the driving force behind the Green New Deal, really did suggest that maybe we shouldn't be eating a hamburger for breakfast, lunch, and dinner. And her office did release and then retract a fact sheet implying a desire to get rid of farting cows. But the actual Green New Deal resolution calls only for a dramatic reduction of greenhouse gas emissions from agriculture. It says nothing about seizing steaks, and no Democrats are pushing to confiscate cows, regardless of their tailpipe emissions. The Washington stir over the burger police is classic political theater, the latest tribal skirmish in America's partisan culture wars. But livestock really do have a serious impact on the climate. And the extreme rhetoric about cow farts and rounding up ranchers is obscuring a consequential debate over the future of animal agriculture in general and beef in particular. Red meat has a greater impact on the climate than any other food. If the world's cattle formed their own nation, it would have the third highest emissions on Earth, behind only China and the United States. Meat is as central to American culture as cars or sports. The average American eats 3 burgers a week, and even more chicken than beef. But this is a delicate time for the industry. The influential Eat Lancet Commission study recently warned that Western diets include far too much meat, and more than half of Americans say they're trying to cut back. New York City schools have adopted meatless Mondays, while fast-growing companies like Beyond Meat and Impossible Foods are selling plant-based burgers and other products that taste, look, and even feel remarkably similar to conventional meat. Burger King has just started selling beef-free Impossible Whoppers. So far, any serious political discussion over the future of meat has been drowned by the cow farting furor, as Republicans like Ted Cruz, Scott Walker, and even Trump critic Meghan McCain have mocked vegan fascists who would, in the words of Senator John Barrasso of Wyoming, force Americans to say goodbye to dairy, to beef, to family farms, to ranches. It's a wildly exaggerated attack, and nobody actually believes we should eat burgers for breakfast, lunch, and dinner, but it packs a punch in a meat-loving country. Data for Progress co-founder Sean McElwee, whose liberal group has helped shape the Green New Deal, says he'd love to rein in the immense economic and cultural power of America's meatriarchy, but his polling has found there's literally nothing less popular than banning meat. It's up there with giving VA benefits to ISIS, McElwee says. That's the tension the left has to struggle with. Democrats eat meat too. But even minor improvement could create massive gains for public health and the environment. In fact, some changes are happening, and some of the industry's advocates and critics agree that the best way to spread them just might be a Green New Deal. The world loves meat, but that love puts pressure on the world. Beef production is the worst climate offender in the agricultural sector. A World Resources Institute report on food sustainability calculated that beef creates about 7 times as many greenhouse gas emissions per unit of protein as chicken or pork, and 20 times as many as peas or lentils. One reason is that grass-eating ruminants like cows release huge amounts of methane, a greenhouse gas 30 times as potent as carbon dioxide. The more significant problem with meat production is that it uses enormous amounts of land, both for grazing and growing grain for cattle feed. Pastures and farms that are used to fatten cattle often replace forests, wetlands, and grasslands that store enormous amounts of carbon. Even America's relatively efficient beef production takes up more than 40% of U.S. agricultural land to produce just 3% of U.S. calories. The U.S. meat industry, though, does more with less compared with foreign counterparts, producing 18% of the world's beef with only 8% of the world's cattle. Kevin Kester, a fifth-generation rancher in Parkfield, California, says it takes him 6 weeks less than it took his grandfather to raise a half-ton steer, and he expects his grandchildren will achieve similar productivity gains. The average dairy cow in California produces 4 times as much milk as a cow in Mexico and 23 times as much as a cow in India. Kester argues that if Green New Deal advocates succeed in reducing U.S. cattle production, it will just move to countries that require more land to produce less meat, endangering carbon sinks like the Amazon and dramatically expanding global emissions. There's so much ignorance about what we do, Kester says. Most Americans used to have a farmer or rancher in the family, but now hardly anyone knows where their steak comes from, and we're way behind the curve on educating the public. The industry's climate message is that it can be part of the solution, not only by increasing yields through more intensive production, but also by storing more carbon in its pastures and cutting emissions from its operations. Bill Gates recently touted the potential of regenerative agriculture, which uses cover crops and no-till farming to keep more carbon in the soil, to grow animal feed with fewer emissions. And some ranchers use climate-friendly rotational grazing to mimic the patterns of migratory buffalo herds. One reason it's become increasingly difficult to do more with less, however, is climate change. Kester has seen his yields reduced by droughts in 8 of the past 10 years, and a nasty weed called Medusa Head Rye has invaded its parched pastures, reducing their carrying capacity by about 20%. If meat producers can set aside their skepticism about the Green New Deal, and Green New Deal supporters can set aside their skepticism about meat, there's potential for a compromise that would provide more lucrative opportunities for meat producers to go green. Eating animals actually helped humans become human. Meat added so much nutrition to the diets of our pre-human ancestors that they no longer had to spend all their time foraging. They started to develop larger brains and smaller stomachs. It transformed our species in a positive way, physiologically and socially, says Marty Matlock, an ecological engineering professor who runs the University of Arkansas Resiliency Center. Matlock is one of the American meat industry's favorite scientists because his studies have documented its improvements and sustainability. In our conversation, he emphasized that meat has helped feed humanity for 2.5 million years, helping to free billions of people from the tyranny of hunger. Yet Matlock also told me, Americans eat too much meat. No doubt about it, he said, for the sake of their health and the sake of the planet, he said, meat eaters, and particularly beef eaters in rich countries, shouldn't just eat more sustainable meat. They should eat less meat. Meat should become more expensive, he said. We shouldn't ration it and turn it into the next cocaine, but we do need options. Impossible Foods is now selling plant-based options at more than 5,000 restaurants around the U.S. Its new partnership with Burger King will start with only 59 outlets in the St. Louis area, but it could catapult the company into the mainstream. The impossible message to the public, conveyed in a new video of expletive-filled double takes from actual diners informed that the Whoppers that they just ate were made of plants, is that you can help save the planet and prevent the use and abuse of animals without sacrificing the joy of meat. Beyond Meat's strategy relies more on the meat aisle of supermarkets like Whole Foods and Kroger. It's now in 38,000 locations in 20 countries, touting itself as a better way to feed the planet. A University of Michigan study found that the company's burgers, made with peas, potato starch, beets, and other vegetarian ingredients that mimic the chewiness, juiciness, and tastiness of ground beef, produce 90% fewer greenhouse gases per pound than conventional meat. CEO Ethan Brown says that if the average American replaced one animal-based burger with a Beyond Burger every week, the emissions impact would be equivalent to taking 12 million cars off the road. Brown is a vegan, and he believes our big brains that developed with the help of meat are now telling us that there must be a way to enjoy meat without increasing our risk of heart disease, treating sentient animals like disposable raw materials, and imperiling the planet. But Brown is marketing to meat eaters, not meat haters, and has found that the vast majority of consumers buying his product put animal-based foods in their shopping carts as well. His investors include the poultry giant, Tyson Foods, and he hired the original architect of the dairy industry's Got Milk campaign to craft his Go Beyond pitch. The most daunting long-term threat to the industrial meat system may be clean meat grown from stem cells in a sterile lab, avoiding the climate effects, moral quandaries, and real-world inefficiencies of raising animals for slaughter. The startup Memphis Meats can convert cells biopsied from a cow into a finished meatball in just a few weeks, feeding them solutions of amino acids, sugars, and other nutrients the cows would have needed to grow. The company hopes to have products virtually identical to conventional meat in stores by 2021. Although its T-bones won't have bones, in the future, customized meat could even be healthier than the real thing, with more omega-3s or less saturated fat. The conventional meat lobby is happy to talk about ways its products can be more sustainable, but it is quite vigorously opposed to the idea of people eating less of its product. And it does see phrases like plant-based meat and clean meat as fighting words. It helped pressure Missouri into passing a law prohibiting the labeling of any product as meat unless it's derived from harvested production livestock or poultry. And 21 other states are now considering similar labeling restrictions on meat and dairy substitutes. Republicans would love the Green New Deal debate to be a referendum on meat, pitting red-blooded carnivores against organic kale hippies. Trump, an avid consumer of fast food burgers and overcooked steak, is already vowing to run for re-election against the Green New Deal and its alleged plan to permanently eliminate cattle. But the status quo with meat is not sustainable in a climate-constrained world, even if meat advocates don't often admit it and Green New Deal advocates don't often admit they want to change it. There's an obvious path to compromise. One former agribusiness CEO told me he often reminds farmers and ranchers who resent being pestered by the sustainability police that they are vastly outnumbered, and that if they don't figure out ways to do better, their critics will end up dictating ways for them to do better. There's such an enormous opportunity to reduce emissions in meat production. If you didn't hear all this counterproductive talk about how everything about it is terrible, said Frank Mitlohner, a professor of animal agriculture at the University of California, Davis. Let's not alienate the people we need the most on our quest for a climate solution. This was adapted from an article that originally appeared in Politico magazine. Two of the obituaries caught my attention this week, and so I'd like to read both of them to you. The first is the NBA Iron Man who anchored the Celtics, John Havlicek, 1940 to 2019. When John Havlicek was drafted by the most dominant team in basketball history, Red Auerbach's Boston Celtics, he decided hustle was the only way to stand out. Look what the hell we got here, Coach Auerbach marveled during Havlicek's first practice in 1962, as the inexhaustible 6'5" guard raced around legends like Bill Russell and Bob Cousy, who were coming off their fourth straight championship. Havlicek became the quintessential sixth man, the first reserve off the bench. People emphasize too much who's starting, he said. Emphasis should be on minutes played. By that measure, the high-energy Havlicek had one of the great NBA careers. He averaged nearly 37 minutes a game during his 16 seasons with Boston and missed only 33 of 1,303 games. I'm ready to go 48 minutes all the time, he said. I get to rest on free throws and timeouts. Havlicek was born in the coal mining town of Martins Ferry, Ohio, to parents who ran a general store, said the New York Times. Fearing traffic on the busy roadway, his parents refused to buy their son a bicycle. So Havlicek sprinted everywhere. Maybe that's where I developed my stamina, he said. In high school, Havlicek was an all-star athlete in football, baseball, and basketball, and earned the nickname Hondo. A friend thought his strong, silent demeanor was reminiscent of John Wayne in the 1953 movie of the same name. Havlicek went on to have a stellar college career at Ohio State, where his relentless, unselfish style of play caught the eye of the Celtics. Their crew-cut rookie immediately was cast as a substitute, said the Boston Globe. Yet Havlicek was a key contributor to the deciding game of the 1965 NBA Finals against Philadelphia. On defense, with 5 seconds left and the Celtics up 110-109, he leaped to deflect an inbounds pass and clinch victory. Johnny Most's radio call, "Havlicek stole the ball," remains iconic. In the 1976 finals, Havlicek played 58 of the 63 minutes in Boston's triple overtime win against Phoenix, despite having torn a muscle in his left foot. He retired 2 years later, scoring 29 points in his final Celtics game. At a post-game press conference, Havlicek said, "When the adrenaline is going, you want to play forever." To which Celtics PR man Howie McHugh added, "We can arrange that, John." And the second obit is the entrepreneur who built a tax preparation empire. Henry Block, 1922 to 2019. In January 1955, Henry and Richard Block decided to take one last shot at saving the struggling tax preparation service of their otherwise healthy bookkeeping business. The brothers paid $200 for a small ad in the Kansas City Star that showed a man behind an eight ball with the headline, "Taxes, $5. The first day the ad ran, customers flooded the Block's office. The brothers were unwitting beneficiaries of an IRS decision to scrap the agency's long-standing practice of preparing tax returns for free. Henry and Richard quickly created a tax specialist firm to meet demand. H&R Block, an anglicized version of Block, B-L-O-C-H. It now has more than 12,000 offices worldwide and annual revenues exceeding $3 billion. We had no idea, Henry said, of the success we would eventually achieve. Henry Block was born in Kansas City, Missouri, to a prominent Jewish family, said the Kansas City Star. He served in the Army Air Corps and World War II, serving as a B-17 navigator in Europe, and was later sent by the military to study statistics at Harvard Business School. But Block had entrepreneurial ambitions and at age 24 founded United Business Company, which offered financial services to small businesses, with his older brother Leon. Things were slow at first, and Leon left to return to law school. Younger brother Richard took his place, and soon an empire was born. Henry was H&R Block's folksy pitch man in TV commercials for decades, said the New York Times. Gray-haired and soberly dressed, he reassured viewers that they needn't face the tax laws alone. He admitted that the tax code's complexity was a boon to the family business. "You can either have a simple tax return or a fair tax return," he said in 1986, "but you can't have both." And we'll finish out the hour on the Talking Points page as usual, starting with the article, "The NRA, Corruption, Chaos, and Civil War." At the moment, you could almost pity the National Rifle Association, said Scott Martell in the Los Angeles Times. The gun rights group has been hemorrhaging money to the tune of $40 million a year. And at its annual meeting last week, an ugly power struggle broke out among its leadership. CEO Wayne LaPierre accused President Oliver North of trying to blackmail him into resigning with a dossier of misdeeds, including on excessive travel and expensing $200,000 on his personal wardrobe. This follows a devastating New Yorker expose revealing a culture of secrecy, self-dealing, and greed, with NRA officers awarding themselves high six-figure salaries and lavish benefits. Meanwhile, the FBI is investigating if the NRA illegally funneled money from a Kremlin-connected banker to Donald Trump's presidential campaign. And last week, New York State's Attorney General announced an investigation of the NRA's tax-exempt status. Clearly, the NRA is now an organization at war with itself, said Lisa Marie Payne in the Associated Press. For a century, it focused on hunting, firearms, education, and gun safety. During the 1970s, it pivoted to Second Amendment rights, but in recent years, its outside ad agency, Ackerman McQueen, has pushed it into cultural war issues far afield of firearms, and it became an overly partisan organization. When the children's cartoon Thomas and Friends added two female characters, one with a dark-skinned face, to its cast of talking locomotives, a mocking NRA TV segment featured several trains wearing Ku Klux Klan hoods and sitting on flaming tracks. Now the NRA is suing Ackerman McQueen for allegedly failing to justify its $42.6 million billings for 2017. All this recalls Eric Hoffer's famous observation, said Charles Sykes in TheBulwark.com. Every great cause begins as a movement, becomes a business, and eventually degenerates into a racket. The NRA's implosion could hardly have come at a worse time for Republicans, said Jim Garrity at NationalReview.com. The cascade of mass shootings in America has energized gun control advocates. Most Democratic House challengers in 2018 openly embraced gun control, and for the first time, pro-gun control groups outspent the NRA in an election cycle. In 2020, it appears President Trump is going to need all the help he can get. The big question is whether the NRA will be healthy enough to be a factor. The census, asking about citizenship. The Supreme Court seems poised to help the Trump administration rig the architecture of democracy, said Jamel Bowie in the New York Times. During oral arguments last week, the court's conservatives overtly defended the administration's attempt to add a citizenship question to the 2020 census, despite estimates that 6.5 million people would not fill out the form as a result. Trump appointee Neil Gorsuch asked why the U.S. shouldn't add a citizenship question like virtually every English-speaking country, while Samuel Alito said he doubted there would be a lower response rate because of this one factor. Three lower federal courts have ruled against the administration on factual and legal grounds, said E.J. Dionne Jr. in the Washington Post. They found that Commerce Secretary Wilbur Ross lied about his partisan motives for wanting to add the citizenship question. But the Supreme Court's conservative wing dismissed all that as irrelevant. By restricting voting rights and now distorting the process for drawing electoral maps, conservatives, including the ones wearing the robes of justice, are openly fighting for minority rule. When did tallying citizens become anti-democratic, asked Jonathan Tobin in TheFederalist.com. Just as Democrats objected to requiring voters to show IDs, they're again exploiting the language of equal rights to give illegal constituents undue influence. The census's goal of counting every U.S. resident was established back when slaves weren't citizens and women couldn't vote. Twisting that to ensure immigrants facing deportation get equal representation in Congress is as bizarre as it is untenable. Legally speaking, said David French in NationalReview.com, Trump's authority to add this question isn't a very close call. Congress gives the Secretary of Commerce broad discretion in crafting the census, and it's not the Supreme Court's job to substitute its judgment for his. Even if the motives behind the citizenship question are apparent, said David Graham in TheAtlantic.com, the effects are not so easy to predict. The census affects not only how seats in the U.S. House are allocated, but also billions in federal funding for Medicaid, highways, and more. If the census undercounts Hispanic residents, blue states California and New York will be hurt, but so will red states Texas, Arizona, and many southern states that have had a big influx of immigrants. It's yet another example of Trump administration policy that could wind up hurting his base. And a couple of short notes. Hispanic American voter participation rates surged by 50% in the 2018 midterm election over the previous midterms in 2014. In 2018, 40% of Hispanics turned out, helping fuel Democratic victories. Public relations specialists outnumbered journalists by more than 6-1 last year. Employment for PR people is expected to grow to 282,600 in 2026, while the number of journalism jobs is expected to shrink to 45,900 over that same period. The majority of the U.S. population under 18 years old will be non-white by next year. Before 2030, the majority of Americans under 30 will be non-white. And a quote from Mark Twain, "Clothes make the man. Naked people exercise little or no influence on society." And with that, we've run out of time for today's episode of the week. I hope you've enjoyed it. Be sure to listen again next time. This is Fred Woodward reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The Triangle Radio Reading Service thanks Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's Reading of the Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, continues to be a true inspiration to their family. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The broadcast is available as a podcast at our website, triangleReadingService.org. Questions or comments, please give us a call,